Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Reid, President Ashley, Congresswoman Berkeley, my good friend John Podesta in the Center for American Progress. I want to thank all of you for who are responsible for putting on this conference. I want to thank UNLV for hosting us and for the work, Mr. President, that this great school does to try to build a clean energy future. And I want to thank my great friend Harry Reid for his leadership in the Senate and for Nevada. If I had done what he said I was afraid I was gonna do when he was talking about the Tahoe summit, I wouldn't be here today. I knew that Harry Reid was interested in doing something serious, and I must say that when we had the 10th anniversary meeting not very long ago at the school up there, I was impressed by the fact that the people in Nevada had been faithful to the agreement we all made 10 years ago. I read the materials on this summit when I was invited to come, and it said the purpose was to produce and pursue an agenda to, quote, accelerate the development of renewable energy, energy-efficient technologies, robust clean energy markets in Nevada, the United States, and the world. That's an agenda that would choke a horse. But it is the most important thing we can be about today. And so on the way out here, I wrote out the notes that I wanted to refer to, so I'll have to use my reading glasses, because I take it we've already made the sale here that this state and our nation and the larger world need a clean energy future. And so I want to talk about the specific purpose of the conference. First of all, a little context. Energy is at the heart of the three greatest challenges the United States is facing today. First, economic stagnation and growing inequality. In this decade, productivity is up, but wages are stagnant. Job growth has been anemic. It will be probably less than 5 million jobs at the end of this 8-year period. Costs for ordinary Americans are soaring, for energy, for food, for health care. Increasingly, they have financed those costs with flat wages through debt, which has contributed, as we all know, to the home mortgage crisis and many other debt crunches, I think, are still going to come at us in waves over the next couple of years. The second challenge is the national security challenge we have, from terrorism, the spread of weapons of mass destruction and conventional weapons, and as we've just seen from the Russian adventure in Georgia, the rise of regional powers who have their own wealth, often fueled by energy, and who may pursue interests that are, to put it kindly, very different from ours. These are all compromised by our dependence on foreign oil. We have borrowed money for 8 years to buy oil from countries that have quite often used the riches in ways that are against our interest. We have run up our own current accounts deficit, contributed to our budget deficit, and compromised the national security. This is, of course, the argument that Boone Pickens has been making going around America about why it's so important for us to become more energy independent. And the third problem, of course, is the problem of climate change. I presume that the argument doesn't need to be made to most people here, or you wouldn't be here. But the general consensus of the climate scientists is that we should reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by the year 2050, a formidable task if we were all going to stand still, and a mind-boggling one when you consider the fact that the world's population is estimated to grow from its current level of 6.5 billion to 9 billion during the exact same period. Now, a lot of good things are going on, a lot of interesting things going on here in this state. huge number of applications outstanding for new solar projects, new wind projects. Not a week goes by I don't read about some new green building effort made by one of the major hotel owners out here. But let's face it, we're not close, not even close, to where we need to be. If you look at what happened 10 years ago this year when the United States and its partners concluded the Kyoto Climate Change Agreement, we have come a long way mentally. When we were having trouble wrapping up Kyoto, I asked Al Gore to go all the way to Japan and try to finish the job, which he did do, and I thought it was an imperfect agreement, but the best we could do under the circumstances. The Senate then proceeded to vote unanimously against it. I think they voted against it before Al Gore got off the airplane. I'm quite sure it's the only bill I ever lost in the Congress before sending it to them. They passed a resolution that, you know, save the energy to send the treaty down the street. 98 to zip. Bill Clinton has lost his mind. This will end the world as we know it if we adopt the Kyoto Accord. The economy will collapse. Civilization will be at a total end. The man has absolutely slipped a gasket. Now, nobody thinks that anymore, at least nobody in this room. You may think I've slipped a gasket, but not because of Kyoto. We have come a long way. Even a Republican president has signed legislation providing for tax credits for the accelerated development of solar and wind and a number of other things. But let's go back to the last 10 years. The main point, I think, that shows that we're nowhere near where we need to be is not the biggest misfortune of Kyoto, which is that the United States bugged out on it, and therefore, and we left in part because we said China and India aren't a part of it. Now, they said, why should developing economies be a part of it? You guys are generating all the greenhouse gas emissions. So we basically used each other as an excuse to do nothing. One consequence is that China has or will surpass us in this calendar year in aggregate greenhouse gas emissions. But the second biggest tragedy is less known. 170 nations signed the Kyoto Accord. It required all the signatories to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2012 to some percentage below where they were in 1990. There were a handful of countries, 12 or 15, I'm not sure exactly how many, for whom the goal was not only achievable, they couldn't help but achieve it. These were countries that were part of the old communist bloc, many of them then part of what was the Soviet Union. They had very inefficient coal-based industrial economies, which collapsed after 1990. So just in the ordinary course of events, they can grow at a rather brisk pace, and they will not get back to the greenhouse gas emissions that they had as of 1990. They'll make it. So you scratch them. There are about 155 countries who signed Kyoto that actually had to make an effort to meet those targets. Guess how many are going to do it? Somewhere between 6 and 8. Now, I would argue to you that in terms of the purpose of this conference, that ought to bother you more than the fact that the United States didn't sign it. Because were the leaders of these other countries, were they dishonest when they signed it? Were they lazy, stupid, or corrupt, and that's why they didn't do it? No. By and large, they were honest, sincere, hardworking public officials who fully intended to do this, but they had no idea how. And there were not in place systems to organize, to finance, and to educate that are necessary to meet the Kyoto targets, much less to meet these much, much more ambitious targets that we're now told we'll have to meet by 2050. So we need to think about how we're going to organize, finance, and train our people to do what needs to be done. And it's quite formidable. Right now, about half the greenhouse gas emissions, probably more or less, are generated through electricity directly or indirectly in running buildings, our manufacturing operations, our homes. There are 5,500 gigawatts of stationary electric power in the world today. 100 of those are wind energy. Less than 10 are solar. About 800, give or take, are nuclear, hydro, geothermal, and over 4,500 are fossil fuels. It is estimated that 5,500 will double to 11,000 in the next 20 years, just stationary electric power. We haven't even talked about driving around in cars yet. And that 80% of the new capacity on present plans will be in fossil fuels, most of it coal. So we're not on the right path, even as everybody is now preparing for a successor to Kyoto, even as we know that the next president is committed to signing some form of climate change legislation in America. And we have nowhere near the organization we need just to pick the low-hanging fruit, which is energy efficiency. I was given a study last year commissioned by Goldman Sachs, which said that if the United States, China, Russia, and India, just those four countries, were to achieve within the next few years the same energy efficiency levels as Japan, that would take the entire world 25% of the way home to an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, just on the efficiency front. So, what are we going to do? The first thing I think we need to posit, and I believe John Podesta is going to ask me some more questions about this, is that we are not going to get close to what we need to do unless we can convince people it's good economics. Now, for a long time, most of the conventional economic analyses said, well, if you really want to do this, you'll have to take 3% or 4% off the world's GDP. And last year, the UN commissioned what was billed as a very hopeful study, claiming that a serious effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions need only reduce global GDP by 1%. First, based on my own experience, I do not believe that. And secondly, if that's our line, we're going to lose. We're going to lose. We are not going to convince the Indias, the Chinas, the other countries of the world to basically make themselves poorer and deal with all the attendant social and political dislocation in order to keep from burning the world up. We should do it. I mean, we should all be willing to take a 10 or a 20 or a 50% cut in income if that's what it takes to preserve the earth for our grandchildren. But given the political realities, that is not going to happen. So the first thing I will posit is, I don't believe it's true. I think that it is good economics to switch to a clean, efficient energy future, not just for wealthy countries, but for emerging ones as well. And secondly, we have to be convinced of that, or we're not going to make the sale. But let me just give you one example. Recently, the state of California commissioned a study by Black and Veatch engineers, which showed that building a 100-megawatt solar thermal plant would provide 10 times the economic benefit of building a comparable coal-fired power plant. It would create 4,000 person years of employment and net $628 million of economic benefit. Now, there are lots of things we need to do to be able to build such plants, but I think it's important. I also would like to just say this about solar. I'll come back to it, but the problem with a lot of this clean energy stuff is that unlike building, let's say, a nuclear power plant, or which is clean on the CO2 front, or building a coal-fired power plant, almost all your costs are up front, which is why you need to reimagine the economics. For example, if you install solar power, 80% of the costs are up front. But once the plant is built, if you build a big solar thermal plant, or once you put the photovoltaic panels on your roof, it only costs after that 2 to 3 cents per kilowatt hour to operate, including maintenance and replacement costs. Now, you pay more because you're paying for the installation. But in other forms of power, a lot of that installation has been subsidized, and that's one of the reasons that we have a kind of a skewed notion of how much the prices are out of whack. For example, original solar plants built in the 1980s are still operating, and today, because of technological advances, they're operating at greater efficiencies than they were when they were first built. And the plants and the cost of operating them are not subject to the fluctuations that are inherent in the international prices of oil, gas, or coal. So, for whatever it's worth, I think we have to prove that this is good economics. Now, since the purpose of this meeting is to set an agenda, I would like to offer 10 things I think the Congress and the federal government ought to do, what I believe state and local governments should do, what the business, labor, faith-based, and non-governmental organizations like my foundation should do, and then offer you one idea that I think has the prospect of galvanizing a lot of this and proving again that it's good economics. What should the federal agenda be? First, next year, even if we don't get legislation that says we're going for 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, the United States Congress must pass legislation that a president will sign that puts a price on carbon and establishes a cap and trade system so that we have a system that will organize our going forward and we are properly pricing something that's otherwise going to destroy the planet. The alternative is to pass a carbon tax with the necessary rebates for low-income and middle-income people. I tried that carbon tax once. It didn't work very well for me, but maybe it'll change. Secondly, the tax credits that we give, either to purchasers or producers of clean energy for wind, for large-scale solar, for the photovoltaics, for geothermal, for wave, first, I think it ought to include all clean energy sources. And secondly, I think it is imperative that the time frame be longer than 3 years, 6 to 10 years. That's the only way you're going to get the production necessary to meet the need. Right now, we would be generating production of wind energy at roughly twice the current rate, maybe more, if the time horizons for investors with the tax credit had been more than 3 years. I talk to people all over America today who are trying to do this wind energy business in their communities, and there is a 2-year backlog for the windmills. So you've got all this interest now. Lord only knows how many things we could have done when oil was $145 a barrel for people that just were at least looking at the long-term trends and not asleep at the switch. And then they find out they got to wait 2 years for the windmills to show up. It is imperative that we have longer time horizons. Thirdly, it's important that we figure out what the federal role ought to be in cooperation with the utilities to modernize the electrical grid in America. In two senses, efficiency and carrying capacity. The grid in America is not as efficient as it should be, and we waste a lot of energy just generating and transmitting electricity. Secondly, where the wind blows and the sun shines, by and large, there aren't many people. Plus, which the people that are there sometimes raise Cain about it. As I saw an article about people in eastern Oregon claiming that windmills were driving them nuts. And we don't know all the, you know, there's nothing, no perfect solution. But I can tell you there are a lot of places in this state, a lot of places I saw in eastern Oregon and eastern Montana, a lot of places I saw along the Rio Grande River in Texas, where the wind blows like crazy, and the most efficient, a lot of places on Native American reservations, and the most efficient place to put the windmills does not have the carrying capacity to take the energy back and put it into the grid. So, and this ought to be something the taxpayers should be willing to split the cost of with utilities. I'll never forget in early March, I think it was March the 1st or 2nd, I was standing on the back of a pickup truck in my cowboy boots in Del Rio and Eagle Pass, Texas. If you've never been there, you ought to go sometime. But anyway, that we had hundreds of people at both these places at little political rallies, and it was cold, but it's, I am not exaggerating. The wind was blowing at 56 miles an hour, and there was not a windmill in sight. And there was no carrying capacity to feed back. So if you want to really accelerate this, which is the purpose of this conference, we have to look at modernizing the grid. The fourth thing I think that should be done is something that was only brushed up in the last energy bill that passed. The last energy bill, which had a lot of good features and some things I didn't like very much, but it basically encouraged the utilities to look at decoupling. Now, for those who don't know, decoupling simply is a way, California has done this for 35 years, which is one of the reasons they're 55% more efficient in the use of energy than the rest of the country. Basically says that there are more ways for an electric company to earn money than to sell more electricity to their customers. That they can also earn money by sharing the benefits of efficiency. And I personally think that ought to be mandated federal policy. This has in the past been a state matter, and some utilities like it, and so far most haven't, because most people like to keep on doing what they've been doing because they know how to do it. But as a result of the decoupling in California, Pacific Gas and Electric and a lot of other utilities out there have financed energy efficiency over the years, have found it's much cheaper than building new power plants, have shared the savings and the cost with their customers, and it's one of the reasons that California is so much more energy efficient than any other state in the country, because they've done that. Now, I don't know what the latest figures were, but the last time I checked on this, it's been a couple of years, California was the only state in the country that had decoupling for electric rates, and there were about a dozen who did it, which did it for natural gas rates. But I recommend it be national policy, because if you give the utility companies a mandate to do it and then create the incentives for saving electricity, they will pursue conservation with the same vigor with which they have pursued new power plants in the past. The most vigorous proponent of this approach among utility executives is Jim Rogers at Duke Power, who said in an interview with the New York Times that if he just put smart meters on all the homes and offices of his customers, just smart meters, which would turn off all appliances at night that are left plugged in. Now, if you're like me and you got a bunch of these TVs, I don't even know if I can get to the plugs on half of my televisions. But you just keep using utility. So this technology would do that. He said that one thing, just turning the appliances off that are left plugged in, would obviate the need for two new coal-fired power plants in his service area in the next decade. That is a stunning statistic. Then if you go from there to peak pricing, so you give people discounts if they do their wash after 9 o'clock at night, you save a lot more. And then the most important thing that could be done, which Jim Rogers and about 20 other utility executives have committed to try to do if they can get the decoupling, is to turn the utilities into the organizers and financers of all building retrofits. For example, if any of you really tried, if you live in an old house, like I do, Hillary and I live in a 110-year-old farmhouse, and I'm really committed to this stuff, and I know more about it than most people, and I have more loose change than most people to finance it. This is not a user-friendly process. You agree with that? All of us that have tried to do it. So what Rogers says is pointed out an interesting thing. He said, if you're strapped for cash, as more than two-thirds of the American families are, and you want to really do the maximum job of making your home as energy efficient as possible, a lot of these things are going to have an 8 to 10-year payout, maybe a little more. You can only get a consumer loan for 1 to 3 years, if you're lucky, 3 years. If the utility does it, that is, if they do the energy audits, if they find the contractors, if they make the process user-friendly, and if the states have the right rate structure, then they see that every building retrofit for exactly what it is, for building a tiny power plant. And you allow the utilities to recover their cost over 20 years the same way they could if they built a new coal-fired power plant. If you do that, since the average home will find its, and the average business will find its utility cuts down from 20 to 50%, its usage, then the ratepayer gets a rate break right away because the utility can pay for it over 20 years. And this needs to be part of running a utility in the modern world. We have got to organize and integrate the incentives for energy efficiency just as we do for energy production. And we ought to be able to pay for it in exactly the same way. This one thing would help us to do what the Goldman Sachs study says we have to do, reach the Japanese levels of energy efficiency and lead the world to see that is really, really good economics. You just think how many million jobs would be created and nobody loses. All you do is reorganize it to financing and who does what when. So I feel very, very strongly that we've got to go from decoupling, smart metering, peak pricing, and organized conservation to where we need to go. The fifth thing I think we should do is to, with federal legislation, accelerate the pace at which we are committed to replacing traditional incandescent lighting with compact fluorescent and LED lighting. I think we ought to also have higher appliance standards on 15 appliances. If you did those two things alone could save us literally dozens of power plants, dozens of new coal-fired power plants in the next 20 years. Finally, I think we need to, on the production side, I think we need to continue to fund projects that will help us to capture and store carbon safely. There are some people who think it can't be done. There are some people that don't want to do it because they think it'll encourage the building of more coal-fired power plants. Look, the Chinese are bringing a new plant on every 10 days or so. And we can't afford not to try to do this. The only place that it has been successfully done on a significant scale is obviously in the Norwegian site under the North Sea rock shelf. But there are lots of hopeful opportunities. In America, the only successful carbon storage has been of any significance is in small volume. It's when we put CO2 into depleted oil wells, which have the capacity to be capped in a vacuum sense. But we've got to do this. So I feel very strongly that we need to do that. Secondly, I think we need, Seventh. We should accelerate the move away from corn ethanol to more sustainable biofuels. And let me say, you know, I spent a lot of time in cornfields this year. And I talked to a lot of corn farmers, and most of them always saw this as a transition. All these ethanol plants that are out there in the middle of Iowa and these other states, they can easily be modified to produce cellulosic ethanol from the leavings of farm crops and other things which do not either raise the price of food or skew the production patterns. The fundamental problem is this. While the conversion ratio for cellulosic ethanol is about twice as good as it is for corn ethanol, the enzyme process that it takes to produce it is more than twice as expensive. So the economics don't work. But if you look at what happened, we had pasta riots in Italy and taco troubles in Mexico this year and all this stuff that's going to happen. And then when we had this explosion in commodity prices just in the last few weeks before oil tapered off, seems to me it would be worth it to have a differential tax incentive to go on and do this right in the first place. To go to cellulosic ethanol, to go to biodiesel, to do these things that we know will work. President Bush announced with the Brazilian president, Mr. Lula, an interesting proposal, which may or may not have any currency in the Congress, that dealt with the 54-cent a gallon tariff we have on sugarcane-produced ethanol out of Brazil. Now, obviously that makes that cane-based ethanol uneconomical, but you should know the cost of converting sugarcane to ethanol is quite low, and it will produce 8 gallons of gasoline, of ethanol, for every 1 gallon of oil. In other words, almost 4 times as good as corn. But we don't want to produce more here. We've done a lot of work to try to preserve the Florida Everglades, and the capacity of New Orleans and in Louisiana to produce more cane is limited. Look at what's happened to the destruction of the wetlands. I think double the destructive impact of Katrina. And now that James Carville's moved back to New Orleans, I'm trying to protect him and his girls from the worst consequences of another 30 years of dumbness down there. So we don't want to do that. So here's what we could do that I think we ought to consider doing. It will be controversial, but I think we should consider doing it. I think we should consider doing what President Bush and President Lula suggested, which is that the Brazilians and the Americans should do a joint investment in the Dominican Republic and other allied countries in the Caribbean where they can easily grow sugarcane and make this and where it would be great for their economy and they desperately need it and it wouldn't be subject to the 54 cent a gallon tax. That may not be politically feasible, but it would make a big difference and it would move us in the direction where we need to go. I'm doing good here. I believe we should accelerate the conversion of all landfills in America to production of waste heat. The CO2 coming out of landfills, by and large, is methane. The volume is nowhere near as great as CO2, but the greenhouse gas effect is worse. It's about over 20 times as bad as CO2, methane. We do a lot of this work around the world with my foundation. We really don't need any more urban landfills of the size they are now. And all the organic material and all the landfills and all the cities of the world shouldn't be there. It's a public health nightmare. It's bad for global warming. And we should just have a national program here to shut down urban landfills and use the organic material to generate waste heat or organic fertilizer. It would be a great thing to do. It'd be good for the economy. And I can tell you, I do this work. It really would be very, very helpful. I think we should accelerate the move to hybrid electric vehicles and modernize the rail networks of the country. For my first 2 years as president, the Congress was very good about giving me enough money to do the research necessary to look into high-speed rail and whether it could be made available to people even in areas of the West, less populated areas, in a way that would dramatically cut energy use, make us more energy efficient, do all that. Then when our party lost the Congress, we were succeeded by a group that thought that that was a form of closet communism. That died. But we need to look at rail transport. And I believe that these biofuels are only a transition, ultimately, to electric cars and someday to hydrogen cars. And we now have the technology available, made in America, to give us all 100-mile-a-gallon vehicles. And so what we've got, it's available now. One particular one I know, because I talked to one of the guys driving a demonstration car, is an electric booster pack that goes in a traditional hybrid vehicle. It gives you 40 more miles of electricity a day, and that takes you to 100 miles a gallon in town, because what it enables you to do is to drive up to 40 miles an hour before you go from electricity into fuel. Now, you can imagine what that would do to the average American's budget if we could get to 100 mile a gallon vehicles. Probably it would require a larger tax credit than is now available for buying the hybrid vehicle, Senator, but it would be worth it, because we know what would happen is the price would immediately drop. All electrical products, they're expensive when they come out, then they go down. Think iPhones, iPods, flat screen televisions. But I think this is really important. And the last point is this. I think we should help demonstrate to the rest of the world that this is not an affectation for rich countries or even a job, that it is, in fact, as big an opportunity for developing countries as it is for the wealthy countries. The most popular thing the United States has done in the world in this decade is embodied in the president's programs for AIDS and malaria, and the massive work done by non-governmental groups like the Gates Foundation, and we help too, and people do all around the world on these public health issues. And that it's given us a model for what we could do for clean energy development in the developing world. Not very long ago, I visited one of the projects that our global initiative helped to get started in a little village in Ethiopia, where they had no power at all, and now they have many little solar reflectors on all the homes. And on one school building, the village asked for one school building. And in this building, in Ethiopia, in a very poor village, there were four light bulbs. And this classroom was designed with help by the people who lived in the village. Catty-cornered, there were two compact fluorescent bulbs. And then in the other corners, there were two LED bulbs. Because the villagers watched them all operate, the compact fluorescent bulbs emitted diffuse light so they could have a classroom there at night. The LED bulbs emitted concentrated light so people could come in and read or work at night when there were no classes. And that's just a little example of something I could give you 1,000 instances of. But I think the United States should follow up on, in a world where we, Lord knows, we need more friends and fewer enemies. If you look at the recent Pew Research, the United States was most popular last year in the Pew poll in two regions of the world. One was in the former communist countries, where they like us because they think we want them in the European Union and NATO. And the other was in 10 countries in Central and Eastern Africa, where they like us because they think we want their children to live. This is not rocket science. And I think it would be a great mistake for us to have all these good domestic policies and not at least have a modest program to follow up. Now, does that leave anything for the rest of us to do? You bet it does. Look at the state and local role. We need better building codes. The city of Houston, normally thought of as America's oil capital, has just adopted the most stringent building standards for new buildings in all of the United States of America, second only to Vancouver, Canada, in North America. They are going to be the most clean energy, energy efficient city in the United States when it comes to new buildings, unless everybody else struggles to catch up. We need organized efforts to do retrofitting on a massive scale. 2 years ago, when my foundation got into this, in the entire world, I already described how much opportunity there was for energy efficiency. In the entire world, only $5 billion was being spent retrofitting buildings. It's a disgrace. If you change the economic model, we ought to spend $300 billion a year on that. Easy. In New York City, we're working with the Housing Authority to cut their electric bill from $500 million to $350 million a year with a 30% cut in the housing stock. It will help the residents in the Public Housing Authority and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In Paris, we're helping them retrofit 660 schools. We need to do more of this. At the state and local level, this is not really a federal responsibility, but I read about this every week in my local newspaper because we're trying to get all the stuff going in this county where I live. There is still an astonishing lack of knowledge among architects, engineers, contractors, and a shortage of trained workers. That ought to be a state and local deal. We just figure out how to do more things like this at a much greater level of detail. I think that states should have their own incentives, and I won't belabor this, but I hope somebody at this conference tomorrow will at least tell all of you who live here who may not know what you have now. Because compared to most other states, it's really good. Maybe you should do a little more, maybe you should do a little different, but at least you ought to know what you have. Because, as I said, every state will be a little different. And finally, pending action by the federal government, I will say again like a broken record, there ought to be an initiative at the state and local level all over the country to shut these landfills down. It's good business and good for climate change. Now, what should non-governmental organizations do? Business, labor, faith-based groups, and just the foundations like mine. I can tell you what we try to do. We just try to help people organize and find an economically affordable way to do what they are otherwise inclined to do. And that's the best thing that we can do. For example, in this building retrofit program, I'll just give you an example of how poorly prepared we are to do what ought to be done. As I told you, when we started 2 years ago, there's only $5 billion being spent a year on this. So what we did was to first organize the purchasers market so we could get lower prices for the most frequently used and the most needed technologies. So we could just provide discount prices. So we could do huge numbers of public schools or huge numbers of universities or huge numbers of government buildings. Then we got the big energy service organizations who do energy audits and guarantee them to agree to participate in this. So if you pay them a premium, they'll guarantee it. That means if you don't get the savings, they make up the difference. Once you do that, any bank will loan the city of Las Vegas money, let's say, to retrofit all the city buildings and to agree to take repayment only in the lower utility bills because they know they're going to get paid anyway, because if the savings aren't there, the energy service organization makes up the difference. And the bank can make a safe loan, something that's much needed in today's banking world, as you know. So I think that, and we started just with these 40 big cities we work with around the world, but eventually we picked up another couple in America, and then we work with the National League of Cities, which has 11,000 communities here in the country. There is a college president's initiative on climate change, which I'm sure you know about. We're helping retrofit a bunch of college campuses around the country. But this is a simple little thing that shows you why the Kyoto Accord targets were not met. Nobody figured out how to make the numbers work. And so this way you can do it without taking any appropriations out of school district budgets, city budgets, university budgets, or anything else. This needs to be done. With solar energy, if we're going to do it on a large scale, we got to figure out how to work out the economics. You either have to have much, much bigger tax incentives because of the front-end cost, or we have to figure out how to use solar thermal power, not photovoltaics, on a larger scale. And we've worked with India, with Australia, and with some groups here in this part of the United States to look at the concept of doing 3 to 5 gigawatts of power in one place over many square miles by putting together the water needs and all the other infrastructure needs and lowering the contracting cost. I think that this has some real merit. I think that there's enough blank space out here that we ought to look at whether we can have some big solar projects that operate on the same model as industrial parks, the research triangle, or the technology centers that have helped to generate economic opportunity in other places. So these are just some examples that I wanted to mention. There is a role for any of us who know how to just do this stuff. There's still a lot of people who want to and can't figure out how to. Finally, the new idea I wanted to mention. We need some way to capture the public's imagination and demonstrate that we all ought to get in this boat and row. And this is the best I can do. We ought to identify some areas in the United States and in the world that will become completely energy independent through the production of their own energy and through energy efficiency. Here are my candidates. Beyond our borders, you can take any Caribbean nation. Lots of sun, lots of wind, relatively low energy use per person, and the ability to cut the transportation costs dramatically. In Africa, I favor Liberia or Rwanda because they're well-governed and very small, so you're not biting off more than you can chew. In Asia, I favor East Timor and Papua New Guinea for the same reasons. In the United States, the most compelling candidate for complete energy independence is Puerto Rico, because they have to import 100% of their energy. The Congress has battled, as you know, for years and years and years about what kind of tax incentives we ought to give to Puerto Rico to get jobs down there, manufacturing jobs. So as a part of America, they will not be so much desperately worse off than the rest of us. A lot of the incentives that have been given and lower labor costs that are enjoyed have been totally wiped away in Puerto Rico now by the fact that they have to import 100% of their energy. And they pay much more for it than the rest of us do. So why doesn't America say that's part of the United States and we're going to figure out a way through the sun, through the wind, and through efficiency, through closing the landfills, through all the stuff we talked about, to make Puerto Rico completely energy self-sufficient? If you could do it, then no one else would doubt that it could be done. The same thing could be done on every single Native American reservation in this country that doesn't have gaming revenues. You generate economic opportunity for the poorest Americans in a way that would serve our larger interest. You could do the same thing in communities in the Mississippi Delta and Appalachia. But there ought to be one state that proves you can do it. And it should be you. Now, and it could be you, not only because of the obvious things, but you have a president here at UNLV and a whole set of university resources that are devoted to this issue, and you have the natural capacity to do it. And you also would have to work through some problems, which would mean that other people could learn from you. I still can't believe that I land out here and don't see any windmills. And I realize there's problems with the airport, the proposed airport, an Air Force base. But the truth is, I mean, look around. And if you had the transmission overhaul I mentioned, you could go much further away from the city of Las Vegas and send wind energy back here. So maybe what you ought to come out of this conference with is a proposal to have the national government and investors all over America and everybody else say, help make us the first completely self-sufficient clean energy state in the United States. I promise you, if you do it, it would rock the world. And don't believe this stuff doesn't matter. For example, I'll just give you one last example in closing. My library is the first presidential library to get a platinum rating, LEEDS rating. And I felt pretty good about it until I realized that I only had to reduce my energy usage about 35% below what it otherwise would have been to get a platinum rating. I was in a completely carbon neutral office building in Rotterdam last year with one of the people who supports our work, and he built it on top of an old building along the water. Then I got to Athens, Greece, and they were advertising their first carbon neutral office building, and there was a line of cars 2 miles long waiting just to drive around the thing. You would have thought it was like when the pandas came from China, you know. The only point I want to make is that's tiny, those carbon neutral buildings, compared to a state becoming energy self-sufficient. It would rock the world. We have got to convince people this can be done and it would be good economics. So I'm hopeful. I came out here 3 years ago and gave a version of this talk to the Nevada Development Corporation. And I had the feeling that some people felt the way they did when Al Gore got off the plane at Kyoto. Now we're all singing out of the same hymnal. We just have to figure out how to turn our good intentions into concrete changes. Thank you very much.